May it please the court, counsel. My name is Matthew Skop. I'm one of the attorneys for Ashley Samas, the appellant in this appeal. And this is an appeal from a dismissal that occurred immediately following the conclusion of the plaintiff's case in chief during a jury trial. And the motions at issue at that stage were one, that Ms. Samas did not prove reputational harm because she didn't prove that the city of Edina decided not to hire her based on the accused statements at trial. And second, the second motion by the defendants and respondents was that the statements at issue did not, or the proof at trial did not give a question of fact to the jury as to malice. And that issue had come up repeatedly during the trial and as to the qualified immunity defense, primarily as it relates to respondent Dvoshak. The court granted the motion to dismiss and enter judgment as a matter of law against Ms. Samas, finding that she did not prove reputational harm. And as to the second motion, the court found that there were questions of fact as to malice and denied that motion. Now here on appeal, we have cross appeals by my client as to the dismissal, and then we have an appeal by the respondents as to some additional issues, requesting that this court essentially affirm the dismissal for reasons other than those articulated by the district court. We would ask at the conclusion here that the court deny the appeal brought by the respondents and remand to the trial court for further proceedings, including the same parties and the same claims that existed initially in this trial. What I think this really comes down to...
Mr. Skap, let's say for the sake of argument, we share your concerns as to the reputational harm. And let's say for the sake of argument, we think that might have been an error. Well, we think that might have been an error. As to... I hope I pronounced it, Dvorak?
I think it's Dvoshak, but I have other people that call it, that refer to it.
Well,
other.
Ms. Dvoshak, he was her supervisor, so presumably he would have a qualified privilege to report, you know, to give a fact-based response as a reference. Well, first of all, would you agree with that?
I would tend to agree with that. I don't want to be pinned down, but I will be pinned down on that one.
What's the, as to Dvoshak, or whatever, Dvorak, let's go with that, because I can pronounce that and he is a composer. What's the evidence of malice on that? I mean, in looking at the record, speaking only for myself, I mean, he was the one who kind of tried to get her job back, and at least the statements that he were making seemed to be qualitatively different from the statements that Ms. Ansell were staked, that Ms. Ansell was making. So as to that person, why doesn't he have a qualified privilege?
Well, I think you have to first look at where the privilege comes from. It's a common law privilege, not a constitutional privilege. And as we've indicated in our briefing, this is actual ill will or a design causelessly and wantonly to injure the plaintiff. The evidence on that issue comes directly from Ms. Samas. She had a conversation with respondent Dvoshak while he was on vacation. He was angry with her. The quote from the transcript on page 148 is Ms. Samas, and I quote, "Well, the tone I would describe is angry, short. Ken seemed really angry with me that I had resigned."
And that's 6 months before, or 5.5 months before, he made the challenged, or the statements that you assert are defamatory to the Edina police officer, right?
That's correct.
But so why would we assume that, I mean, why is that context, or I guess that delay of time, given that delay of time, why would a jury assume malice in statements, especially when the anger was about her leaving because he didn't want her to leave? Why would we assume?
And then try to get her back.
Because I think that the context shows that she didn't come back, and he was upset about that. The evidence reveals that not only was he upset during that conversation.
The fact that he was upset that he wanted to come back and she didn't proves he wanted to sink her for all types of future employment. That seems a bit of a stretch to me.
He was angry. And if someone leaves and you put that person in control and in charge while you go on vacation, an extended vacation is what the record reflects, and that person quits while you're on vacation, putting you in a difficult position, admittedly, anger is not unexpected. But to say that there can't be a six-month delay, or someone won't hold a grudge, or someone won't look at that employee, and when asked to provide a truthful evaluation of that employee's quality, that that person would not falsify the quality of that employee and say she just doesn't get the dispatching piece when the job she is applying for is dispatching, that is a factual misrepresentation by this supervisor.
We're talking about actual ill will. Is there anything about the statements that reflect that transitory anger 5.5 months later? I mean, anything about the language used or tone of voice that is of record?
The statements themselves intrinsically reveal, especially when we compare this to the other evidence at trial, that this individual had it in for Ms. Samas. Now, I don't know any other way to say it, but when you read those statements in context and you compare that to Ms. Samas' employment evaluations and the testimony at trial from officer after officer who said she was a great dispatcher, she's one of the best, anyone who makes a statement that Ms. Samas doesn't get dispatching, that statement itself is inherently and intrinsically evidence of someone's desire to sink her as a candidate for this new job. Now, that issue is one that came up a couple times, once at summary judgment, I believe, and it came up again at trial. And all we are asking in regard to that is that question be put to a jury. Here, what the court did is it took away a constitutional right to a jury trial in a tort matter, and it pulled the rug out from under Ms. Samas at the end of her case in chief because of a misunderstanding, a fundamental misunderstanding in the law and what it means to have defamation per se distinguishable from defamation cases. I deal with this all the time. And there just seems to be this fundamental misunderstanding that permeates the case law. District court judges have difficulty understanding that it can be this easy to get through the crucible of summary judgment for someone who has asserted this defamation per se claim. I want to just briefly address to the suggestion in the briefing, the last brief by the respondents, suggests that there's some kind of nuance that the court should read into defamation per se case law and find that there is an actual effect. And they take this word effect and they italicize it and act like this is somehow a new element of defamation per se in the state of Minnesota. I submit to this court that if the court reads the case law in context, it's going to find that this word effect is used to discuss a definitional aspect of many types of defamation per se case law. It's not to say that you're adding the element that it had to impact or affect
this
person.
It's not a causal connector, because in fact when you have defamation per se, you're taking that causation part out. I mean, I think I understand your argument that it's not consistent with the whole notion of it having a per se.
Exactly. It adds a new element that doesn't exist anywhere else in the case law to say that this word effect actually has the meaning ascribed to it by the respondents.
Can I switch, because I know you're moving through your time. Is there a distinction in your mind as between the two county individual defendants with respect to the availability of qualified privilege?
Absolutely. With regard to Lynette Ansell, she was basically a coworker. It was not part of her job description, any part of her job, to go and to provide or opine about fellow employees. She just happened to be doing this because she had a prior working relationship with Sergeant Raffidel at Edina, who was conducting the background study.
And Raffidel testified, if I understand, I don't go to HR. I want to go to the coworkers and get the real scoop on somebody.
That was
Didn't he reach out to her as a coworker?
That was his perspective, but what matters more is the definitions of what she was supposed to be doing, what her job description is, and that is her burden. So this is a, you know, qualified immunity is something you don't just get to say, hey, I get qualified immunity. You have an obligation to present facts that show that you're entitled to that immunity.
So you were going to ask the jury to decide whether she made her statements on a proper occasion and for the right motive and that kind of stuff?
Well, at a minimum, it has to go to the defendant's case to demonstrate that Ms. Ansel's job description included providing these reviews of other employees. They can't do that. I mean, it's going to be impossible for them to say that this was part of her job. And the bottom line is this qualified immunity.
I thought, and I don't have the site in front of me, but I thought someone at Scott County testified that she could do that.
The fact that anyone can speak to someone conducting a background study does not equate to someone that is part of their job. Now, Dvořák's job included this sort of function of reviewing employees. So with regard to him, we acknowledge and accept that he gets that qualified immunity and we follow through to the common law malice. But as to Ansel, there is no evidence in the record that she's entitled to the protections of this qualified immunity.
Well, of course, we hadn't gotten to the defense case yet.
Exactly. And the problem is that in our case, it's not our obligation to show that someone else has this qualified immunity. It's not our obligation to come forward with testimony or facts. And so at this stage, in the plaintiff's case in chief, we aren't proving their case. And the only way for them to show that she's entitled to qualified immunity is for them to present evidence, which they haven't done. So at this stage, this discussion about qualified immunity is premature as to Lynette Ansel. Because at this juncture, there's just no evidence from the defendants as to that question. Now, I acknowledge this is generally a question of law, but it requires production by the party seeking to assert the privilege. And at this stage, the production has not occurred. That production occurs during the defendant's case in chief, and that hasn't happened yet.
Was there evidence in the record that the background examiner discussed with Mr. Dvořák that he might contact Ms. Ansel also to seek information from her?
I believe it was actually the other way around. I think it was Edina suggesting that, Sergeant Raffidel suggesting that he might speak with Ms. Ansel. Now, I think that's clearly a question, and I think the issue in the case law is not, did this person act outside the scope of what they were supposed to be doing? It's whether this was one of their job duties. So if I talk to a background investigator at the coffee shop and say some negative things about a coworker, I'm not going to get qualified immunity for that conversation. It has to be that Scott County monitors and decides that this person is going to be the conduit for reviews. And when that person speaks, that person needs to be open, honest, and they need to have the protection of this qualified immunity, which is why the courts over the years have said, we're not going to require constitutional malice as the standard. When it comes to employers, it is qualified immunity and common law malice, which is a much lower standard, is what you have to survive. Here, there's a question of fact, at a minimum, for the jury. The jury could have said, I do think that Dvořák held a grudge, and I do think that these statements, especially when compared with Ms. Samas' outstanding performance record, the testimony of her manager, who said she was a rising star, and she said that she was great and she was next in line, when compared to those statements and how negative those statements are, any employee in Minnesota who experiences this kind of essentially blackballing should have a cause of action. And it shouldn't be every argument under the sun, which the respondents have asserted. I acknowledge some of them are very creative, but at the end of the day, the defamation per se case law remains the same, and that was misapplied by the district court when it dismissed this case and sent Ms. Samas home. So with that, Your Honors, I'd ask the court to remand for trial, keeping all of the claims and all of the parties the same so that Ms. Samas can have her day in court. Reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Scapp. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondents, please.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Adam Wattenbarger, and I am one of the attorneys representing Scott County and the two individual defendants in this case, Lynette Ansel and Ken Dvozhak. There are really three arguments that we have as to why it would be proper to affirm the dismissal of this case. I'll start with qualified privilege, since that was the bulk of the discussion so far. Qualified privilege bars liability for defamatory statements. If the statements were publicized in a context that courts have deemed sort of a proper occasion with a proper motive, so long as there wasn't the common law actual malice.
So is the analysis the same for both Mr. Dvorak and Ms. Ansel?
It is.
Dvorak was her direct supervisor. Ms. Ansel was a coworker.
Sure, and these are certainly relevant facts in terms of analyzing whether the privilege should apply.
Well, if there were facts, then why wasn't a jury allowed to make that determination?
Well, the question of whether the privilege applies is a matter of law. That's clearly been defined as a question of law. Certainly, had the defense put on its case, there would have been more evidence put in, but there's certainly evidence in the record that clearly establishes that this was a proper occasion for both Dvozhak and Ansel to respond to these inquiries.
But Mr. Schapp argued that the case law only recognizes the privilege as applying to a employee who's as part of their job provides employment reference information.
And that's
not part of Ms. Ansel's job, is it?
Well, it's not listed as one of her specific job duties, but there's nothing in the case law that indicates it has to be someone's primary job duty on their job description to respond to an employment reference check or to give any feedback of this nature. It's undisputed that this was in the scope of her employment, that she was responding to these inquiries.
She was at work when she got the call. Is that what you mean by scope of employment?
She was at work when she got the call. Her supervisor permitted her to respond. She did not reach out independently. This wasn't her going out of her way to make comments. She was reached out to by Sergeant Rofidal. He contacted her to get her feedback, and she responded.
Why is this even an issue? Because at least in the district court's order that it filed on February 6th, at least implicitly, the district court recognizes a qualified privilege may apply, but indicates that there are issues with respect to whether the statements were made with malice. And whether they were made with malice seems to me to be a particularly factually based determination that would best be done by a jury. Why, if that's what the district court really limited it to the issue of malice on qualified privilege, so why wasn't there a fact issue on the malice regarding these two individuals if the premise is that, okay, there's a qualified privilege, but it can be waived or voided by making statements with malice?
I would agree that malice is a fact question, but it is still appropriate to direct a verdict when there is no evidence or such little evidence that there would be no reasonable basis on which a jury could find a fact in the plaintiff's favor. And here, the simply,
onto that, but you know, and I want to follow up on Judge Flory's excellent question. I mean, okay, fine. It's your job to give. Let's say, for the sake of argument, we agree with you that she can talk. Ansel can talk about coworkers and references. There seems to be based on the differences between Dvorak's comments and her comments, a qualitative difference. Just based on the comments themselves that suggest there's one thing, she wasn't a good dispatcher. Her dispatching skills were questionable. Okay. That all seems okay, she shouldn't be a dispatcher. Versus, she'll stab you in the back every time. I mean, if someone says to me, You know, Judge Connolly will just stab you in the back every time. That sounds like they hate my guts, and or at least it's a question that, someone could... I think someone could reasonably assume that if that's what they're saying about me, they don't want me to succeed. And I think that would suggest that there might have been some malice motivating her comments. You know, particularly, you know, she was the protected child of the previous manager. I mean, that sounds like someone's a little spiteful. Or at the very least, sounds like a jury could think about that. So why doesn't that go to the jury on malice?
Well, for one, I'll note that the sort of the way that this has been argued is that, you know, Dvořák had malice, but there hasn't really been an argument presented.
Well, let's say the second word, I agree with you. I don't think Dvořák had malice. I'm talking about Ansel.
Right, right.
Isn't there enough evidence to suggest that Ansel's, the question of whether Ansel had malice against, I've forgotten her name, Ms. Sames, should have gone to the jury? Because those statements alone seem to be explosive.
Well, there's almost no evidence in the record that would suggest any, you know, extrinsic improper motive on the part of Ansel.
I'm talking about those words themselves seem to suggest.
Well, for one, I would argue that those are largely statements of opinion, which kind of relates.
Well,
to
that's a different issue, and we'll get to that. But so you don't think that those statements alone could suggest malice to someone who heard them?
I think that the purpose of the, you know, without showing some extreme degree of exaggeration or some level of something to the statements that suggests that she's going out of her way to have ill will or improper motive, I don't think these get there. There's a lot, even having just presented the plaintiff's side of the case, there's plenty of evidence in the record to suggest that she wasn't an undisputed perfect employee. There's certainly evidence about her authoritative management style, about her being difficult to work with. She conceded
that. Yeah, but the stabbing in the back and the, you know, the kind of petulant, she was the, you know, the
teacher's pet.
Protected child. I mean, that it seems to me that the language used in the statement can intrinsically suggest that, you know, not only am I trying to convey information, but I'm trying to poison the well.
I would agree that the language can do that.
You don't think this language does.
I don't think this language does, given the context that it was being stated in. She was clearly, you know, talking about her, you know, the ways that she interacts with coworkers, her management style. These were descriptors that are relevant to the way that she would perform in a high-stress setting, and was.
She would stab someone in the back. That's how she'll perform in a high-stress setting. I mean, that seems like. That goes straight to her job performance and would be pretty poisonous to a future employer to be told that. Not to mention our Supreme Court, as far back as 1977, recognized the statement stab in the back as slander per se in the Anderson versus Kammeyer decision. How do we get around that?
Well, I would note that in the Anderson decision, the stab you in the back was specifically directed in the context of don't do a business deal with this individual because he'll stab you in the back. She was talking more about interpersonal relations.
Well, I mean, you know, would you, you're going to hire someone who responds to 911 calls, and depending on who's making the call, she'll stab you in the back. Boy, that's not the person I'd want. You know, I wouldn't want to call that person. I don't want that person to pick up the phone when, you know, I'm trying to get the police here.
Sure. Boy, and I think that's the reason that the qualified privilege is important, because we want people to feel like they can be honest.
Absolutely.
And express.
She's a bad dispatcher. You know, she doesn't pick up the phone within 30 seconds, you know, blah, blah, blah. That all seems to be absolutely what a reasonable job referencer can give in a background check. You know, she doesn't come to work on time, she doesn't pick up the phone, you know, but stabbing in the back, you know, the protected child, that seems to be not quite going to whether she's a good dispatcher or not. That seems to be going to, you know, I really just hate this person's guts and I want to sink her every way I can based on what sort of when I was around with her when, you know, her protector was there. Or at least it suggests to me that there's a fact question. So why don't we, I think we've exhausted that. So you think that this is all opinion? So what's the argument that this is all opinion?
Well, and this is, and, you know, we've kind of walked through each individual statement in the briefing. Probably not time to, you know, parse out each one individually. But I do think that when the statements are looked at on an individualized basis, they are all, or at least largely all, statements of opinion that are not actionable. You know, the Minnesota Supreme Court has confirmed that statements of pure opinion are protected from defamation claims in the McKee case. And we cited in our briefing a number of cases from this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court finding statements that relate to, you know, assessments of someone's work skills to be pure statements of opinion. So someone having an insufficient level of accountability, someone being a brown noser, someone even being fluffy or a bitch was considered not actionable. There are a number of cases in which these sorts of terms, even terms that are somewhat hyperbolic or exaggerated, are considered statements of opinion. We've included a number of citations to those in the briefing, and
What about the statement that Ms. Sames did not hold herself accountable for small errors and was quick to point errors out to other dispatchers? I mean, that's a fact-based statement, isn't it? Either she did or she didn't hold herself, you know, or call things to other people's attention.
Yes, well, and that is one, and I believe that's among the list that, let me see here. Yeah, I mean, so that one is one that is ultimately undisputed as a matter of a true statement there. There is evidence in the fact that she, in the record, that she was quick to point out errors in others. And that also is kind of a paraphrase.
What if that statement was made with malice?
What's that?
What if I say, what if it's, say, assume for the sake of argument, that the evidence indicates I am out to get you, okay, and I'm making these statements with malice, assume that, then even if this is not an opinion, if I'm saying she doesn't hold herself accountable for small errors, and I'm saying that specifically because I have malice towards you, why isn't that a jury question?
Well, I think that, I mean, so we're assuming that there is malice.
You're assuming I have malice against you, and I'm saying that statement with malice. Why isn't that actionable, even if it's true?
Well, if it's a true statement, then it's a true statement. True is a complete.
And that provides any defense to malice, if it's true.
A true statement a true statement would be a full defense to a defamation claim, and so the malice at that point would.
But here we don't know if this is a true statement or not, because we didn't get everything in front of the jury, and it sounds like there was conflicting evidence. While there was evidence about her management style, there were also coworkers who testified that she had a very, you know, to the opposite. So, I mean, it seems to me the fact that it's disputed means it goes to the jury.
Well, it seems to me that there's ample evidence in the record about concerns about her management style. She acknowledged in the testimony, transcript page 202, that other supervisors had said she was being too hard on dispatchers. So there's evidence that people, you know, held these opinions. And so I do think that this constitutes, you know, essentially a statement of opinion as to the quickness at which she would point out errors.
A question, because I see you're running out of time, and
yes.
That is the question about defamation per se.
Sure.
And the argument Mr. Schopp made to the panel was that you really, and maybe the district court picked up on it, are trying to insert an additional element that in fact the per se eliminated, and that is that the plaintiff has to prove causation in a sense, that the statement affected actually in a causal way the plaintiff's employment or business. Is there a case law that suggests that that is true?
I believe it is consistent with the case law and the way that it's been applied. This is somewhat of an atypical case in that the plaintiff put on their entire case and put forth no evidence of the actual effect on her job search. So the cases where you see this applied, it's normally, you know, there's already in the facts that it did affect, so like the Stumpkes case where this was, where defamation per se was applied. It's clear in the facts that the statements resulted in an employee agency saying they would not place someone.
But the whole idea of defamation per se is that the plaintiff doesn't have to prove that.
The idea of defamation.
Causal harm, but that it has, the statements made have to be of the type that affect your business. And there's no question here that these statements went directly to Ms. Sames in her professional capacity.
Well, defamation per se, it certainly means that if you fit into one of those categories, you don't have to prove actual damages. But the element of some causal effect is an essential element of the statements themselves being defamatory. Defamation per se is a rule of damages, not a rule of liability. And the defamation categories account for this by applying to charges of a crime, imputations of unchastity, and statements that affect someone in their business reputation. That affect language is there and has meaning, as it should, because otherwise, I mean, you know, a statement that has zero effect, that is completely harmless, there's no reason that that would result in a defamatory claim. And so the case law and the standard for defamation per se does account for this. I do believe it is consistent, but this is applying it in a unique situation where there truly was nothing that could allow a jury to conclude without purely speculating that there was a causal effect here.
Well, maybe you've gotten to my question too, but I mean, the judge's two-page order that he filed in this doesn't give us a lot of insight into the basis for his determination, but I'm troubled by the language in the conclusion of law that there's no legally sufficient evidentiary basis for a reasonable jury to find for plaintiff on the issue of whether she suffered harm to her reputation. And when I look at the line of cases with the Supreme Court, starting with the Ritchie case, which says, moreover, in cases of defamation per se, common law allowed harm to reputation to be presumed. And secondly, if you look at this Longbine versus Schoenrock, it basically says the same thing, that it's actionable without proof of damage, actual special damages, and the plaintiff may recover without any proof that the defamatory publication caused him or her actual harm. And then when I read that into context with the Supreme Court's decision in the Schliemann case that basically says, says, and I quote, because defamation per se defines a rule of damages, not of defamatory meaning, the jury retains the ultimate responsibility for determining whether statements that relate to a person's business, trade, or professional conduct are in fact defamatory. I don't know what he means when he says evidence as to harm to her reputation, which under these cases is presumed. How do I get around a misapplication of the law in that order there if I look at this Supreme Court authority and the fact that it's recognized this as a factual issue?
Please answer the question, Counsel. All right.
Well, there's a lot there. First of all, it is a question for a jury whether statements that relate to someone's business are defamatory. However, as with all jury questions, directed verdict is appropriate when there's not sufficient evidence to bring it to a jury. So I think the fact that it's a jury question doesn't defeat the properness
except
of the directed verdict.
Except in this case, harm is presumed. So they don't have to prove harm, actual harm.
Under defamation per se doctrine, damages are presumed. The harm to reputation is part and parcel of whether there was some effect on the job here. Is theoretically.
Well, I mean, she didn't get the job. I mean, it sounds like either she didn't get the job because she was being defamed, or she didn't get the job for some other reasons, but.
And we have nothing in the record that would indicate one way or another. She didn't get the job. That's all that we know. There was no one, not a single decision maker from the city of Edina was brought forth to say we were influenced by these comments. No one who had knowledge of their decision.
So she has some, well, in assuming a best case for the plaintiff, she has a conditional offer. Then the police sergeant speaks to these two people, listens to Ms. Ansel say these things. and I know the argument, well, you know, the psychologist kind of gave her this information to gauge her reaction, and it was that reaction why we didn't hire her. Well, you know, I don't think I buy any of that nonsense. But it seems to me this is a fact question, at least to what Ms. Ansel has said, and particularly combined with, as Judge Flory pointed out, you don't even have to prove reputational harm. And even if you did, it seems to me there's enough here to say, well, she didn't get the job. And these statements, I mean, I cannot say with a straight face that if someone said to me, boy, Judge Connolly will stab you in the back, I wouldn't hire Judge Connolly. Whoa. I mean, bleh. You know, for anything, let alone a dispatcher.
Well, the reality is that several witnesses came forward and said that they didn't think less of her reputation at trial. So not only was there not evidence that it affected, there's evidence that it didn't affect people's reputation of her.
So I assume no one from Scott County spoke to anyone in Ramsey County, which is why she's got a job there now, right?
Again, there's nothing was presented to make that distinction, but she did quickly get
it up to a jury to draw inferences from the evidence that was presented, including the fact that she did not get the job that she had been conditionally offered before the alleged defamatory statements were made.
It would be up to a jury if there was some evidence for the jury to consider on that front, but it's appropriate for the trial court to direct a verdict when the evidence is so minimal or absent that no reasonable jury could reach that conclusion. I do believe that there is a distinction between proving that there are actual damages for defamation per se and establishing that there was some level of harm or some level of effect to your job or your profession. Absent that, statements that are completely shouted in the wind would theoretically be defamation per se. And so there needs to be some showing that these had an effect. There's not a heavy bar. You don't have to prove, calculate the money that she lost or the time that it took her to get a new job, but there has to be some effect. I do believe that's consistent with the case law. We would request that the court affirm the judgment of the district court. In the alternative, if there is a remand, we would request that the court limit it to the specific defendants or the specific statements that are deemed to be actionable in this case. If there are no further questions, I'll
thank you.
There.
Not at all. No, I think we've pestered you enough.
Thank you.
We'll now hear for counsel for the appellant, please.
Thank you, Your Honors. The issue, I think, just taking this in reverse order, starting with the defamation per se, the definition, what we see in the case law is statements that are reasonably capable of defamatory meaning. We don't see an additional requirement that those statements are then analyzed and looked at as to whether Ms. Samas lost a job, lost a contract, lost friends, lost the ability to participate in an organization. Those are all measurements of damages. So if Ms. Samas had shown those things or can show those things, then damages get higher. But as we've demonstrated in the briefing, when it comes to that analysis, we don't set the bar at actual harm. We look intrinsically to Ms. Samas and we say, was she humiliated? Did she lose sleep? Was she insulted by these statements that were made? There's a slippery slope in this discussion, in this argument, where if we require a defamation per se plaintiff to canvass the world for every person who viewed a YouTube video or an internet posting, it completely turns defamation per se on its head. It changes the elements, it changes the proof, and we can go back and look at the case law, and it says the same thing. It says you don't have to prove reputational harm or that you lost a job if the statements themselves can be examined and analyzed and are capable of defamatory meaning. And that's a reasonableness standard. It's not an actual proof, go out and find someone who thought less of Ms. Samas standard. With regard to the spitefulness of the words, I agree. And it doesn't matter that some of that terminology and phraseology is arguably opinion, because there are other statements of fact. So when you look at those statements that are made, the spiteful statements about Ms. Samas by Ms. Ansel, that alone is intrinsic evidence of malice. But before we even get to that point, I'd encourage the court to look at the case law as to qualified immunity. Our argument stands that this is not a person in this context having this job that is entitled to qualified immunity. She doesn't get it, and she hasn't carried the burden of production on that issue and can't do that until they get to the defendant's case in chief. With regard to Respondent Dvořák, the statements that are most concerning and factual, and I hear this argument, well, this is opinion. It's not opinion. And if we look at these statements in context, these statements are statements that can be proven, they can be measured, and they can be analyzed, and are done, and this is done all the time by employers all over the state of Minnesota. When Mr. Dvořák, Sergeant Dvořák, says that Ms. Samas just doesn't get being a dispatcher, that her dispatching skills are questionable, he is speaking directly to her quality and her qualifications. And when someone speaks falsely about an employee's quality or their qualifications, that employee has the right to come to a Minnesota court and seek redress. And this is precisely what Ms. Samas has done in this case. We've cited a lot of case law about what's opinion, what's maybe an offhand remark that wouldn't be subject to the defamation moniker. The issue here is that this was not a water cooler conversation. This was not a conversation at a bar. This was a serious conversation. So we can't just laugh off or ignore the statements that were made as maybe having a little bit of fluff in them or exaggeration. This was serious conversation, serious discussion about whether someone was going to get a job. She ultimately didn't get that job, but whether she gets the job or not is not how this claim rises and falls, and that was the trial court's problem. The argument was made to Judge Werminger. They didn't prove that she didn't get this job because of those statements, therefore they haven't proved reputational harm, therefore her claim should be dismissed. He made the wrong decision. This court's an error-correcting court. There's clearly an error by the district court in applying defamation per se law. And under the circumstances, we'd ask the court to remand without any instructions other than this trial should go forward with the same claims and with the same parties. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is submitted. That was our last case on the oral argument calendar today, so therefore we are adjourned.